The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Pay disparities, wealth disparities, the concentration of wealth in the top 1% of workers. It's easy to talk about, easy to get mad about. Politicians and economists talk about it all the time. Doing something about it, that's hard. But there may be something happening in California that can signal a national change in the disparities between the pay of men and women. Disparities that have such a long history with deep cultural roots that there was something of a playful joke back in the 1949 film Adam's Rib. Here, Katharine Hepburn plays a lawyer up against her husband, Spencer Tracy, in a case involving gender equity. And Spencer Tracy wasn't very happy about the way things turned out in court or in his marriage.
This is basic. I'm old-fashioned. I like two sexes. And what is more, I suddenly don't like being married to what is known as a new woman. I want a wife, not a competitor. Competitor, competitor. If you want to be a big he-woman, go and be one, but not with me.
But this romantic humor of the 1940s has become a very real campaign issue. It's given birth to the legal and economic doctrine of comparable worth, and was something President Obama made very personal during his reelection campaign in 2012.
I've got two daughters. I want to make sure they get paid the same as somebody's sons for doing the same job. Very straightforward. Any confusion there?
There's plenty of confusion, in fact. The Obama daughters will leave the White House far short of any guarantee that their pay in the workforce will equal the men working alongside them. The Obama name might help Sasha and Malia, but for women with no presidential pedigree in the federal workforce, they can expect to make about 79 cents for every dollar men earn. Maybe they should move to California, where the just-signed Fair Pay Act may begin to clarify things. Here's the sponsor of the bill, AB 1354, Assemblyman Bill Dodd.
Women are head of household in 40% of the household. It's not just a gender problem. It's a family problem. It's a human problem. And essentially what 1354 does is this makes sure that in the state of California that we're going to practice what we preach.
The Fair Pay Act will allow employees to get and exchange information about their company's pay scales without repercussions. It will force employers to justify salary differences between men and women or take steps to equalize them. The law is one political consequence of a court case filed by a state employee, Aileen Rizzo, who sued after discovering she was paid $12,000 less than a colleague in the same department with considerably less training and seniority than she had. Her case is pending, but she believes the new law signed by Governor Brown is the writing on a wall that she says is finally coming down, and an end to the roadblocks that she and many other women have faced.
One of the major ones was my prior salary. When women hold their prior salary, they're holding something that's a burden to them. They're carrying it with them, especially when employers are consistently asking you, well, what did you make before? Well, what did you make before? The doors just closed as soon as I asked the question, why is there a discrepancy? And it was like a shuffle of trying to make sure that no one talked to me, that I would have absolutely no way to solve it internally in the organization itself.
Were you able to discover what the pay was of your colleague in a public manner, or did that require some investigation on your part?
No, it was public. He was sharing with someone else and was sharing it openly of what he had gotten on his first contract. And then the other males were quick to share it as well. And there has to be a way to create a salary policy that's based on your experience and education. Other county offices are doing that, and that's a much more fair way to pay someone and more valid, business-valid reason rather than just getting your previous salary.
Now, the law says that, and again, the previous salary law hasn't been signed yet, but this current law says that businesses can discriminate or can justify a different salary between a man and a woman as long as it's a non-gender-based reason that would include a seniority system, a merit system, earnings that demonstrate an individual's quantity of production or quality of production, or some kind of education, training, or experience. Now, how difficult would it be for a company to basically say, well, Joe over here is a genius. I mean, he's a college dropout, sure, but I mean, he has so many innovative ideas. We just had to take him, and that would be enough.
Well, that wouldn't be a valid, what I would consider a valid business reason. And really the burden is on now the employer instead of before it was on the plaintiff to try to prove that there was some equality there and that there was no reason to pay someone different. But now the burden is on them, and it has to be a really good business reason. It has to be something that's valid and has merit. It can't just be something like, oh, we like him better or we think he has great ideas. It really has to be something that's documented, real proof.
If the only solution because of economic problems, an economic opportunity a company might take, if the only solution in a company were to basically reduce the salary of all men to equalize it with women, how uncomfortable would that make it for you in your office if that was the solution or the scenario? I'm not saying it is, but if it were?
That would be a difficult thing. That would be. But my thoughts on this is that why pay for so much of this legal fees that they're going through to fight equal pay litigation that's against them? Why not just make it right? How much money are they spending on litigation when they could have just made it right to begin with? And if it's made right now, then that could be something that allows this to perpetuate and close the gaps for women.
And you have a stake in this in the sense that you have some employees on their way to the workforce in your own family. Aren't you worried that your daughters may go into the workforce and they'll look at your name and go, oh, you're the daughter of that rabble-rouser? What do you tell them about sticking up for the principal here?
I'm definitely not worried about that. I hope that they have a heritage of knowing that nothing is fixed. And if there's injustice, you can do something about it to make a difference. Lobbying and testifying for the California Pay Act was a distinct privilege. And I had no hope that it would help my case, but I knew that it would help others. Because isn't it enough if you discriminate against one person? How many people do you need to discriminate against for it to be wrong? So I'm ready to hold them accountable for that and see what happens.
She's a workplace activist, but she's also a math consultant for the Fresno County Office of Education. Aileen Rizzo, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Would you share your salary information with other employees? Should they disclose their pay to you? Winter Park, Florida. Absolutely. The only reason to keep salaries a secret is to give the employer the ability to discriminate between employees. It should all be public. No shame in discussing.
This is Jerry Lynn Intrican calling from Bedford, Texas. Salaries of executives at publicly held companies and at nonprofits as well already are public knowledge. In order to attempt to equalize pay between workers, transparency of benefits packages is necessary.
My name is Karen Dewey, and I'm calling from Newport, New Hampshire. I worked in public education for a number of years. It has always been somebody else's business what I was paid. Maybe if everybody's was, it might help level the playing field.
Rogers, Arkansas. No, compensation is an agreement between employee and employer. So how transparent are the pay patterns in your workplace? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. The U.S. Marketer-in-Chief, U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker, arrives in Cuba this week. She will observe the aggressive construction of new hotels and tourist attractions financed by French hotel interests and Chinese construction companies. Trade currently off-limits to U.S. companies, including Pritzker's family-owned Hyatt hotel chain, under the Cold War embargo still in place. Pritzker's role as a booster of U.S. businesses is constrained by the embargo and also by Cuba's own cautious opening to the U.S. and its fear of being overwhelmed by its neighbor to the north. Born in Havana, Carlos Gutierrez served as U.S. Secretary of Commerce from 2005 to 2009 under President George W. Bush, when trade sanctions were the centerpiece of U.S. policy. But Gutierrez says the time for talking trade with Havana is now.
I was part of an administration that had a totally different policy towards Cuba. It wasn't a policy that sought normalization. However, I agree with President Obama's policy. I think the time is right. I think that for once, both sides have a common interest, a mutual interest. The fact that today Secretary Pritzker is in Havana is another indication that this time it's different. This time there is real will on both sides to start this journey toward normalization.
You had extraordinary management credentials before you began your service in the Bush administration, both with Kellogg and with Citibank, et cetera. But Secretary Pritzker is in an unusual situation in that she is, you know, represents a pretty huge fortune on her own. And yeah. I'm wondering if the Cubans look at her government credentials or look at her bank statements in terms of what she can do for them.
Well, you know, I think that both sides have understood that we're talking about two different cultures and two different economies. But, you know, if it weren't for the embargo, maybe the secretary would be thinking about doing business in Cuba and the tourism industry. Part of the problem today in Cuba is that, you know, the French are building a 5-star hotel. The Chinese are building a 5-star hotel. But you don't hear about Four Seasons or Hyatt or Marriott or anyone else. So I'm sure that will ring a bell with the secretary, but her mission is a lot broader. This is the first time I can remember a Secretary of Commerce being in Havana, especially after 1959. So her mission is one of moving the ball forward, making sure that as we are thinking about regulations, the Cubans are thinking about those same regulations as well. And even though the embargo's in place, that we can do as much as we can to help the Cuban people while the embargo is still in place.
Without betraying any confidences and as diplomatically as you can you describe a lunch or a meeting that you've had with a Cuban entrepreneur who talks the talk very, very differently from what we've understood historically, and that
sure.
If that becomes public, we will see a real change business-wise?
Well, you know, I actually visited a co-op, which is the new form of businesses that they have in Cuba. And that's the one thing that really struck me the most. It used to be a state-run firm, and they turned it over to the employees. The employees elect the board, and it's done very democratically. It's a textile factory. But the key thing is that the people are making three times as much as they were when it was a state-run firm. And at the end of the year, they get profit sharing. So, you know, that is an example of a model that I hope they're going to roll out. But in addition to that, I visited someone's home who was selling his house and showed me around his remodeled bedroom and bathroom and everything he's done to the house. I mean, that was unheard of 10, 15 years ago. You talk to taxi drivers who now have their own license to be a private taxi driver. Before, they were all employees of the state. So everywhere you look, you see that type of change. Stores, barbershops, beauty salons, things that weren't there before, sprouting all over, at least Havana, what I saw in Havana. And I think that's extremely positive.
Carlos Gutierrez served as U.S. Secretary of Commerce from 2005 to 2009 under President George W. Bush. He's currently a chair of the Albright-Stonebridge Group in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Volkswagen spent $77 million this year to tell American drivers they could have it all. Clean diesel engines and high performance.
Aren't diesels dirty?
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that used to be dirty. This is 2015.
No. Listen to me, Terry. Diesel in Latin means dirty.
The Volkswagen Passat TDI Clean Diesel can go up to 814 highway miles on a single tank.
Something stinks, I'm telling you.
It must be the diesel.
The ads failed to mention, though, that the cars only looked clean when they were getting tested by inspectors. Once cleared for emissions, a deceptive digital device told the engine it was free to pollute, as it turns out, up to 40 times more pollution than allowed under U.S. emission standards. The enticing ads are now gone. This has become a global scandal for VW, with a management shakeup, criminal investigations underway in Germany and Italy. The FBI is pursuing criminal charges here in the U.S., and now at least 30 U.S. states are investigating, including New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who joins us now. Attorney General, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be here, John.
What can you accomplish in state investigations that's not already being handled by the FBI?
Well, the The FBI is looking into possible criminal violations. The states, and we're now up to 45 states and the District of Columbia who joined our multi-state investigation. States have two categories of laws that are at issue. One is the consumer protection laws, because this was clearly a massive fraud on consumers. Almost 500,000 of these secretly polluting vehicles were sold into the U.S. And then some states, including New York, have environmental protection laws, which also have penalties. So we're going to be seeking to coordinate our investigation. And then different states have different provisions. But the Volkswagen has liability to the federal government, the state government, and there are private lawsuits being filed. It was a consumer fraud that resulted in people not getting the cars they thought they were purchasing. They claimed to have redesigned their engines very cleverly to comply with tougher standards on pollution from diesel cars. In fact, all they did was program their cars to commit fraud.
Now, isn't that fraud to the EPA, not necessarily to the consumers, who might be more interested in fuel economy than they would necessarily be in emissions?
No, they're really different types of claims. The EPA has enforced the Clean Air Act and other environmental laws, but consumers who thought they were buying a car that was not polluting the air and that had the peppy engine with gas mileage, as you say, were clearly defrauded. And I'm sure Volkswagen will be sending out recall notices to offer to repair the car. But really, even if they do hook up the pollution controls, because what they did was they had pollution controls that were cleverly designed only to go into effect when the cars were being tested. They pulled off the road and put up on a test track. As soon as the cars were off the rack, the pollution controls turned themselves off automatically, and they dumped, it's estimated, something like 12 million tons of nitrous oxides and other things into the air. So it's a problem for consumers, it's a problem for the federal government, and they violated a lot of state laws. It's going to be a steep price for Volkswagen, and they're going to have to try and fix the cars. But even if they repair the car and install the pollution devices, the consumers are not going to have the cars they hope, because they're not going to get the good gas mileage and the performance if they're complying with the emissions requirements, because that just reduces the power of the vehicle. So either way, consumers are entitled to something. The state has laws to enforce, and the federal government is looking into it as well.
Do you have to demonstrate specific harm to specific consumers who are outraged by this and become plaintiffs, or can you act on behalf of the consumers for a variety of reasons, including just dirtier air, as well as them not getting the cars that they bought?
Yes. In New York State and many other states have consumer protection laws that allow us to impose penalties for fraud. So we're acting as the sovereign defending our citizens. And consumers also may be entitled to some relief, but it's something that we're going to have to sort out. I'm sure that some of these states will be consolidated. But this was really an extraordinary level of fraud. I mean, we're talking about 11 million cars overall, about 500,000 sold into the U.S., that were literally programmed to commit fraud. They were programmed to beat emissions tests. And Volkswagen engaged in as you noted earlier, in a huge advertising campaign to convince the public that they had some great technical innovation that allowed them to comply with higher diesel fuel emission standards while still delivering good mileage and good performance. And it was just, it was all a lie. And 11 million cars is a lot of cars that are polluting the air much more than we thought it was. Furthermore, under the federal laws, states are all required to meet certain targets for reducing pollution. And all of the targets of all of the states have been off because we've been using estimates that were based on Volkswagen's fraudulent numbers.
So it would seem that this case would differ from the tobacco lawsuits in the sense that there wouldn't be necessarily a pool of damage money that would then be directed back to consumers, even though you probably would collect significant fees and penalties from Volkswagen. Eric Schneiderman, can I ask you one more question about an unrelated issue, but one that's in the headlines right now? What do you make of this potential fraud in the fantasy football scandal where possible insider information has rigged the game for some people playing on one of the fantasy football company sites?
Yeah, well, it's something we're taking a look at. Fraud is fraud, and consumers of any product, if people participate in, whether you want to buy a car or participate in fantasy football, our laws are very strong in New York and other states that you can't commit fraud. So this is another example of the cleverness and the real sort of deviancy that goes into some of these fraud schemes. If these folks would just apply these their skills and their talents to doing something right, this was for example in Volkswagen. This is an incredible accomplishment of engineering. It was just a fraudulent accomplishment of engineering. And the fantasy football sounds like it could be the same situation. I don't have comments on the specifics of that matter at this time, but fraud is fraud, and we'll investigate it wherever we find it.
Well, lots of work for New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, lots of money at stake in both the fantasy football case and the Volkswagen case. Eric Schneiderman, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Once again, the U.S. role in Afghanistan is being questioned by an aerial attack last week against the Taliban that hit a civilian hospital in the city of Kunduz. Once again, the Taliban is making significant territorial gains against the year-old government of President Ashraf Ghani. Ghani ran on a platform to open talks with the Taliban and end fighting that began years before the 9/11 attacks and the U.S. invasion that overthrew the Taliban 14 years ago.
I call on Afghan government enemies, particularly the Taliban and Hezbi Islam, to prepare for political negotiations.
That's President Ghani speaking about negotiations with the Taliban at his inauguration. But a year later, the Taliban looks stronger than ever, and it is not the only Islamist group confronting the Kabul government. Hassan Abbas is a professor at the National Defense University and a senior advisor to the Asia Society. Hassan Abbas, is the Taliban stronger than ever right now?
Taliban are quite strong, there's no doubt about it. But also we have to keep in mind that this is a time that they are facing a severe challenge from this new movement, ISIS. Secondly, Mullah Omar, their unique leader who led the movement through all the difficult times, is dead. So they are splintering as well. So they are directionless, and in this directionlessness, they are trying to gain some more momentum and gain some sense of where they stand. These two things have to be kept in mind while trying to assess where Taliban stand today.
What do you make of the battle over Kunduz? Is this a symbolic battle right now?
It is a symbolic battle which shows us a few things. The Afghan Taliban were maneuvering, thinking, planning about this campaign for over a year or so. So this was partly the failure of the Afghan government to strengthen their system and establish their writ of the state. And that created that vacuum. And then Taliban came in with a strong action. And Afghan military and Afghan forces in that area were taken totally by surprise. And then there are mistakes, which we have seen this attack on the hospital, which then creates further problems in terms of public perception. This is symbolic of an overall, I would say, chaos or lack of an overall unified Afghan state and society, which is then enables Taliban to try to play their game.
In general, if we were to look over the past 14 years, the U.S. investments in nation building in Afghanistan have been more like Taliban building. If you look at the efforts on the ground and the results on the ground, wouldn't you say?
Some efforts were, I think, well-meaning, but it takes time. For instance, all the investment in the Afghan military and police. I think that there was a lot of hard work and effort and planning that went into it. But the fact is that it takes decades for any law enforcement or military institution to become strong and to develop their own ethos and their own pride and their own professionalism. But it was never a short-term game, or it was never a short project. We were fooling ourselves if we thought in 5-10 years we'll be able to reverse this trend. In this age of ISIS and religious extremism, we have to think about continuing effort to help states build. After all, they are going through almost 30 years of war. They were the front line for us, for the West, and for democracy against Soviet Union. We tend to forget that. So we owe them some support in some shape or form. Not necessarily. It doesn't mean that we have to have 15, 20, 30,000 troops on the ground. But it means a continuing commitment to development, to their financial stability, and other countries have to also do their bit.
Hassan Abbas is a professor at the National Defense University and a senior advisor to the Asia Society. His book, the paperback edition, which just came out, Taliban Revival, Violence and Extremism on the Pakistan-Afghanistan Frontier, is now available. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We began this hour talking about being truthful about unequal pay for male and female workers. Then we talked about deceptive machines committing felonies on the roads. Here's a story about a ninth grade textbook that makes what seems to be a monstrous claim about African-American slaves.
The Atlantic slave trade between the 1500s and 1800s brought millions of workers from Africa to the southern United States to work on agricultural plantations.
That line is actually in the brand new edition of the ninth grade McGraw-Hill World Geography textbook under the heading Patterns of Immigration. It makes it seem as though Africans somehow signed up to work in southern plantations, as though they got paid for their work, and as though they weren't rounded up like livestock thrown into filthy boats to cross the Atlantic in the dark, where many of them died before they ever did any of this so-called work. Even the number is wrong. Estimates from the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database say perhaps 388,000, not millions, came to North America, all told. This past week, a ninth grader in Texas and his mother questioned McGraw-Hill over this bizarre description of slavery. The publisher has since issued a statement, which you can read on their Facebook page. It says, among other things, this book meets the learning objectives of the course. However, we conducted a close review of the content and agree that our language in that caption did not adequately convey that Africans were both forced into migration and to labor against their will as slaves. McGraw-Hill has also stated they will change their language in the digital version of the textbook and in the program's next print run, which could be 10 years away. And students who are exposed to this aren't just in Texas, but in all the other states that carry this McGraw-Hill textbook. Dan Quinn is a former social studies textbook editor, and he currently works with the Texas Freedom Network. Dan Quinn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What does the Texas Freedom Network have to do with monitoring textbooks and these kinds of issues today?
So we were founded in 1995 as a public education and religious liberties watchdog. And one of the first things we did was go to the State Board of Education here in Texas and monitor how they adopt textbooks. And our founder, Cecile Richards, actually, she has a little note that we have on the wall. This is even worse than I thought. It's a very politicized process. Publishers are sort of put through the mill when they have a textbook that comes up for adoption here. And we spend our time monitoring that and trying to counter efforts to censor those textbooks.
And what do you make of this particular reference to the Atlantic slave trade?
Well, it's certainly unfortunate to say the least. We don't recall this particular passage being part of the debate over the social studies textbooks that were adopted last year. It's hard to know why it happened. It could have been quote-unquote honest mistake by an editor. It could have been just something that happened in the editing process. Who's to know? But it does raise questions, particularly in a state like Texas, where you have politicians that determine what more than 5 million kids are going to learn in their public school classrooms. They've politicized the process here so much that when something like this comes up, you have to wonder, what's the source of this? Why did they try and downplay this in the textbook?
How can this be an honest mistake? It says that somebody believes that the slave trade was sort of an employment arrangement. It's utterly monstrous.
Yeah, it's dreadful and boneheaded. There's no doubt about it. I'm encouraged that the publisher has immediately said, yes, this was a bad thing to do, and we're going to make the change here. I don't know. You know, I worked in the industry for a while, and I'd like to think that it wasn't an editor there who was sitting down saying, we're going to deliberately downplay the role of slavery and how horrible it was. I do have to say that most of the textbooks that we saw last year do a pretty good job of describing slavery in the United States. In fact, they do a much better job than the very politicized curriculum standards adopted by the State Board in 2010. I mean, those standards actually downplay the role of slavery in United States history. One of the board members, in fact, argued that slavery was a side issue in causing the Civil War, that it was really all about states' rights. And that's the way they wrote the standards. The standards say nothing about segregation. They say nothing about the black codes. They say nothing about the KKK even. But the textbooks do talk about all of that. The problems come in, though, when they come before the board. They sometimes have to shade things. They have to muddy the waters a little bit because these are for-profit companies. They invest millions of dollars in these textbooks. They want to give the customer what the customer has asked for. Otherwise, they're going to lose a lot of money. So I think sometimes they make some compromises, they shade things a little bit. But there's no doubt this was a really boneheaded thing to write, and it's dreadful, and I'm glad they're going to change it.
You know, in a textbook where you're trying to convey a shared sense of history in classrooms that are presumably diverse with African-Americans and white kids and Asian kids and Hispanic kids, and we're having so much trouble in the last couple of years reconciling that common view of history where, you know, blacks look at a policeman and, you know, their families recall the history of law enforcement and violence, whereas whites look at a policeman and see, you know, Mr. Safety. It seems this is exactly the kind of thing that exacerbates the kinds of problems that you have in places like Ferguson.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And that was one of the arguments that we made before the State Board of Education when they were adopting these textbooks. You have to teach students the truth. I mean, there's a reason why this country is still arguing about the Confederate flag flying at state capitals and Confederate heroes statues on university campuses like here at UT Austin. And that's because we haven't told children the truth in many cases. Generations of Southern children have grown up learning that the Civil War was fought over some sort of noble cause like states' rights. No, it wasn't. It was fought over the right to enslave human beings. And students should learn this information. When you have curriculum standards like we do in Texas that downplay that role, all you do is make these problems in society even worse. And we continue to argue about things that historians tell us are essentially based on nothing other than just a political argument.
If McGraw-Hill had made a mistake that said that the Declaration of Independence was written in 1676, I mean, wouldn't they do a print run to correct that immediately?
Yeah, I mean, you do have to wonder about the expenses involved in this, but I would suspect that they would be doing a lot to change their textbook. I mean, this really is kind of a symptom of the problem we have here. How is it that a textbook got through the adoption process here without a passage like this even being noticed? Well, that's easy to answer. Politicians on the State Board of Education here are more interested in promoting their own particular political beliefs than they are in making sure that the textbooks themselves are accurate. So they have a very deeply flawed adoption process that really doesn't allow for the in-depth examination of the textbooks that are really needed. So now we have these textbooks in the classroom. The publisher's scrambling to figure out what to do. It's going to cost a lot of money to do whatever they want to do. Meanwhile, you have students with textbooks that are deeply flawed because of passages like this. That's a big problem.
Dan Quinn is a former social studies textbook editor. He currently works with the Texas Freedom Network, which is a watchdog agency that oversees the editing of textbooks in the state of Texas. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
And finally, here's something to take with you today. Russian video producers are apparently having a great time bringing footage of the Russian air campaign in Syria right into the living rooms of Russians. Russia's round-the-clock news channel shows Russian fighter jets dropping bombs on terrorists using new T-50 fighter jets. Russian troops on the ground can be seen enjoying the comforts of home, drinking Da juice, and smoking Sobrani cigarettes. The Russia 24 news channel had this. Good weather for bombing in Syria, she says. A commentator on an opposition newspaper website wrote, even in the USSR, they didn't get propaganda into the weather forecast. Take us with you. Subscribe to the Takeaway podcast. Find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story or tweet us at The Takeaway. Comment at thetakeaway.org. So many ways to find us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.